you know, you get the feeling that you don't own the business, that it belongs to the community, and that's huge.
Alaska loses an historic roadhouse. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a former Eagle River resident qualifies for the Summer Olympics.
Told her, I said, well, I was praying for you to win this shoot by at least 8 to 10 targets, and darned if she didn't win it by 10 targets.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Eagle River's 25-year-old Corey Cogdell is headed to the Summer Olympics in London. International trap shooter Cogdell won the U.S. Olympic trials in Tucson, Arizona by 10 shots, beating out four other women. She hit 47 out of 50 targets at morning trials on Sunday to take the lead into the final trial. Cogdell will be the only U.S. Olympic competitor in women's international trap shooting at the Olympics this August. Cogdell now lives and trains in Colorado, but she grew up in Alaska. Her proud father, Dick Cogdell, remembers her earliest attempt at hitting a target with a little chipmunk rifle.
On her second birthday, her mother made a cake and had two candles, and we had her blow them out, and I asked her, I says, well, Corey, what'd you wish for? And she said, I can't tell you. Mama said that my wish won't come true. And I said, oh, you can tell Daddy. And she just looked at me, and she said, shoot, Daddy, shoot. And I took her out at her on her second birthday out on the deck, and she must have shot 50 different rounds with this little single shot 22. She was hitting targets like five rounds, and she hit her first target.
Dick Cogdell says his younger daughter, Corey, learned from observing her older sister shooting. Corey Cogdell now hits flying targets that travel 75 to 80 miles an hour, shooting out from ground-level bunkers that throw the bird target from different angles and directions.
I keep telling Corey, I says, gosh, I can't go anywhere anymore that somebody isn't saying, hey, congratulations, hey, how's Corey doing? Like I told her, I says, well, I was praying for you to win this shoot by at least 8 to 10 targets, and darned if she didn't win it by 10 targets.
Cogdell beat the 100-degree heat in Tucson by relocating there 3 weeks before the Olympic trials and getting acclimated. She also prepared for windy conditions, which continued through the 3-day event at the Tucson Trap and Skeet Club. One of Alaska's historic roadhouses was destroyed by fire over the weekend. Glen Ridge Fire and Rescue responded to the blaze at the Copper Center Lodge early Sunday morning. Firefighters were unable to save the 116-year-old roadhouse. KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
Owner Todd Huddleston says no one really knows how the fire started. He believes it started somewhere in the back porch area. By the time he arrived on scene, the blaze had taken its toll on the historic roadhouse.
We just couldn't get enough water on it to get it shut down. And I mean, thankfully, the volunteer fire guys showed up, and they kept all the surrounding buildings good, so we kept all those. But I just appreciate everything they did. They worked their butts off. I just appreciate that.
The cause of the fire is still under investigation. This isn't the first fire the Copper Center Lodge has experienced. Built in 1896 as the Copper Center Roadhouse, a fire in 1928 destroyed everything except the dining room. It was rebuilt in 1932. A general store and a post office were added in 1935, making it the center of commerce in the town. The lodge has been in Huddleston's family ever since his grandparents, George and Kathy Ashby, purchased and renovated it in 1948. Huddleston and his wife acquired the lodge from his mother in 2002. Ever since the fire, he says he's had people sobbing over the loss of the lodge, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. Huddleston says he has been very appreciative of the community support.
You know, I have a group of people that meet here every day. Every year round, they meet here every day. And they're still here. I mean, they still showed up. They don't know where else to go. So, you know, you get the feeling that you don't own the business, that it belongs to the community, and that's huge.
With tourist season starting up, Huddleston says the incident isn't going to stop him from doing business.
I have a mobile kitchen, And I have my old Club 96 building, which is an old saloon, and I'm going to serve food out of that mobile kitchen. So we'll still be able to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner, at least that much out of it. There'll be indoor dining and outdoor dining, so we'll see how that goes.
Huddleston is hoping to rebuild the Copper Center Lodge. He says he already has a plumbing contractor lined up and is looking for an engineer. He says he will begin work on the new lodge as soon as he gets more information from the insurance company. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The Department of Natural Resources has notified Alaskan Crude Corporation, a Texas-based oil company, that it will end the unit agreement and state lease on more than 6,000 acres near Dead Horse. However, the company took the decision to court, arguing that it still has issues under appeal from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and that the department has made unilateral changes to its unit agreement. The Supreme Court has ruled against those complaints. Deputy Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash says it is not unusual for leases to terminate. However, they don't usually end up in court. It's more common for a company to voluntarily relinquish a lease if exploration proves unsuccessful. State leases and any subsequent unit agreements have time constraints to become productive. He says Alaskan Crude's time has run out.
We've had enough of a track record here to show that the activities that are even being proposed are ones that aren't necessarily going to move this lease into production. And so we've taken the action we did. The lease will go back into the pool, and you know the owners at Alaska Crude Corporation are free to bid at the next lease sale and get those leases right back if they're the high bidder.
Alaskan Crude claims the state has put obstacles in the way of its development, particularly with the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's refusal to consider its request to be considered a gas-only development. That would have lowered the standards the company would have to meet for spill response requirements. Balash says the commission decision is part of the process.
Everybody who takes out a lease with the state of Alaska, when they do so, is required to follow the rules and regulations of state, federal, and local agencies. AOGCC is a state agency. They made a decision according to their rules. We expect operators here to follow the law.
Balash says there are now limits to what will be included in unit agreements the department approves. Some are based on lessons learned from the state's agreement negotiated with Exxon over Point Thompson.
Specific terms of their unit agreement that was formed back in the early 80s had some features in it that we probably won't ever repeat, and it was in part those specific terms that Judge Gleason used in her finding against the state when we terminated the Point Thompson unit.
Litigation is still pending with the commission, and the Alaskan Crude Corporation could also appeal the DNR's unit termination. The first results are beginning to come in from the International Polar Year, a global effort to collect scientific data on the Arctic and Antarctic that began in 2007. The National Research Council published a summary last week, and APRN Steve Heimel has some highlights.
It was mostly about vanishing ice. 2007 was the year sea ice flowed out of the Arctic Ocean and melted back to a record degree. And at the other end of the Earth, the ice sheets of Antarctica were being washed by warmer waters and breaking up. In both cases, the scientists were there to see it and take measurements.
These ice shelves are disintegrating, and by that we mean it takes thousands of years to form, and they're falling apart literally in weeks.
That is glaciologist Robert Binchandler of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, co-chair of the committee that wrote the International Polar Year, or IPY, report. Geologist Julie Brigham Greta is the other co-chair.
It's fortuitous that the first full year of the International Polar Year, we saw the greatest demise of the Arctic summer sea ice.
They both describe a situation where scientists thought they were going out to collect baseline, a kind of detailed snapshot of the current situation to use for comparison as the climate changes in the future. Instead, they found themselves watching the changes as they happened. The Canadian icebreaker Amundsen found open water in the Arctic Ocean even in the dead of winter. And in Antarctica, scientists using precise satellite altimetry found over 100 lakes in a system of mountains buried beneath miles of ice. Ben Chandler says it was a complete surprise to discover the water actually adding to the underside of the ice.
Underneath the ice sheet, the Antarctic ice sheet, where you have this rugged alpine environment, the water can flow uphill because it's the pressure of the ice pushing down on this water that dictates which way the water goes, not just the slope of the valley and the rock. And so in some places, you have enough heat to melt the ice at the base of the ice sheet that produces water, and then the shape of the ice sheet's pushing that water up a valley, up into colder temperatures where it refreezes, refreezing on the bottom of the ice sheet that are hundreds of meters thick. And it's the kind of thing that, as a scientist, you get excited about, but your colleagues simply cannot believe it when they first hear it.
But it's completely confirmed in just the beginning. Julie Brigham Greta says much of the important science from the IPY has yet to be published.
We have an army of young graduate students and early researchers who are certainly still synthesizing that data, working up theses and dissertations, and then that takes a while in the scientific process to go through peer review.
The big question of what they call the mass balance, or how much total ice is melting compared to what's being added to the ice sheets, will probably be answered soon. But it will take longer to nail down what they call teleconnection, or what the polar changes mean for more populous areas in the temperate zones. Indeed, the report's authors say data gathered more than 50 years ago during the International Geophysical Year of 1957 and 58, when the first satellites were sent into Earth orbit, is still being used. Ben Chandler says that international effort actually began the era of remote sensing that is now absolutely critical for scientists.
In my 30-plus years of doing polar research, I really have had the opportunity to live through this revolution. We used to be data-starved. Then satellites come along, and then they start collecting all kinds of data from different sensors looking at different aspects of the polar regions. And all of a sudden, things are changing rapidly, and we see these changes. Had we not had the advantage of these comprehensive observations from space, we wouldn't know that this is going on at all.
The International Polar Year has put in place all sorts of monitoring networks for keeping track of the Earth's temperature system, but no nation has made much of a commitment to pay for keeping the measurements coming. The report suggests an international effort of some kind. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, young Bethel residents successfully lobby the governor.
Dear governor, please sign the contract so we can learn how to swim and have fun in the pool.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
An election recount board has released the results of a hand recount of the votes cast in 15 precincts during the Anchorage municipal election. The board spent the past couple of weeks checking paper ballots against voting machine results and voter registries. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The 12-person election recount board met at City Hall Monday morning to sign off on their report. They found that most precincts were only off by one or two ballots, but Precinct 840 had 205 signatures more than ballots. Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler was on hand to explain.
The voters apparently signed the voter register, but also signed the question register and had their ballots placed in question envelopes. And we think we have them all accounted for with the exception of eight. It may be, we have some anecdotal evidence of this, but it may be that those eight persons could not wait in line any longer. And although they had signed the register, they left without actually casting a ballot, which is why you have more people who have signed than ballots cast.
Wheeler said the same was true in Precinct 660, where the count was off by six. The recount was ordered by the Assembly after a group of voters petitioned the clerk's office for it. The April 3rd municipal election was fraught with problems. An Election Commission report blamed the clerk's office for not distributing enough ballots. More than half of precincts ran out of ballots. The Anchorage Assembly has appointed a retired judge to pinpoint what went wrong. His report is due out by June 28th, and it will be used as a guide to improve future elections. Denise Stevens is a member of the recount board. She says the anomalies they found happened because precinct workers did not know how to handle the unusual number and varied types of question ballots that were cast when precincts ran short of normal paper ballots.
At the precinct, they didn't have a clear understanding of what they should do with those ballots once they were cast on a non-card for their precinct, or they were on a facsimile or a copy or a question, you know, a sample ballot, and they were put in question envelopes. So normally, if it's in a question envelope, you only sign the question register. But at the precinct that day, because it wasn't a normal question envelope, they had them sign both.
Assembly Chair Ernie Hall observed the election board's meeting. He says he's relieved that the recount is finished, and he's ready to move the process forward.
I'd be anxious to see how it gets handled. My anticipation is it'll pass.
The full assembly will review the recount report and vote on whether to certify it at their regular Tuesday meeting. Election board members will answer questions from assembly members. There will be no public testimony. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The only hospital in the Bristol Bay region is now officially designated as a trauma center. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services announced Thursday that four hospitals have garnered a Level 4 trauma center designation. They include the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham, the Providence Seward Medical Center, the Providence Valdez Medical Center, and the 673rd MDG Hospital at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Those hospitals join the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Regional Hospital in Bethel, the Sitka Community Hospital, the Mount Edgecombe Hospital, and the Norton Sound Regional Hospital in Nome as the only Level 4 trauma centers in the state of Alaska. Arnie Loetta is the clinical director for the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation, which runs the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham. He says Level 4 trauma centers can provide a level of expertise that can allow more patients to survive their injuries.
Level 4 designation means that our hospital has met the best requirements given the facilities that we have to initially evaluate, stabilize patients during their assessment process and transfer them as appropriate, you know, to higher levels of trauma care. Level 4 is the basic one, but if patients aren't initially treated as close to home as possible for trauma, then it's clear that outcomes are not as good as when you have a organized method of assessing them and rapidly transitioning and changing them to a higher level care as appropriate.
Currently, there are no Level 3 trauma centers in Alaska, and the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage is the only Level 2 trauma center. There are no Level 1 centers in Alaska. Julie Rabeau is the trauma program manager for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. She says with the addition of the four hospitals announced Thursday, nine of the 24 acute care centers in Alaska currently hold trauma center designations.
Also, Providence Kodiak, South Peninsula Hospital, and Bartlett Regional Hospital just recently also are in the, they have done their verification visit. They have passed that. They're just waiting for designation. So we'll actually be up to 11 by the end of June. And we have one Level 2 trauma center, which is Alaska Native. So we're thrilled. This will bring us to a total of 12, which is half of what we want is all 24 to eventually be designated.
The trauma centers in Alaska are judged by a team of healthcare professionals that use the trauma criteria put forward by the American College of Surgeons. Rabeau says it's unlikely Alaska will have a Level 1 trauma center anytime soon.
Most Level 1s are university-based or research-type hospitals.
Trauma is the leading cause of death in the U.S. for those between the ages of 1 to 44, and Alaska has the second highest trauma death rate in the nation. Loetta says trauma is the leading cause of death in the Bristol Bay region.
A lot of trauma is preventable, and wearing your float coats, using your helmets when you're snow machining, all of those definitely would reduce the amount of trauma and mortality and morbidity that we suffer in our region.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services asserts that there is up to a 25% increase in survival rates for seriously injured patients when they are treated at a designated trauma center versus a non-designated trauma center. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Rural Alaska Native college students say traditional culture and mentorships help protect against suicide. The National Association of Rural Mental Health held its annual convention in Anchorage last week, with sessions ranging from aging and mental health to workforce development, and one gathered Native students' views on suicide prevention. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
National Association of Rural Mental Health President Linda Werlein says their annual conference gives mental health service providers a chance to learn about research, best practices, and relevant programs. Something she wants the public to understand is they have a role in promoting mental health, too.
Everyone can be aware if they see signs and symptoms with a family member or a friend to get them into someone who can help them and get them back on the right track.
One of the presenters was University of Alaska Fairbanks student Christopher DeCue, who researched the beliefs, opinions, and experiences of rural Alaska Native students on suicide. Alaska has the nation's highest rate of suicide. Alaska Native men between the ages of 15 and 24 have the highest of any demographic in the country and among the highest in the world. With his associates, DeCue interviewed 25 Alaska Native students at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, asking them what protects against and what contributes to those high suicide rates.
By and large, the most commonly mentioned protective factor against suicide was traditional ways and subsistence lifestyles. Moreover, they talked about mentor relationships. Mentorship as being an important protective factor and having a meaningful relationship with a caring adult. A huge focus was grandparents and grandparenting, the importance of elders and adults from inside the community who were talking with them and supporting them in the process of growing up and learning.
For example, DeCue cited one of the students who had quoted a grandparent saying, "No matter what happens, no matter what you get yourself into, no matter what it seems like at the time, suicide is never the answer." Marie Scannis analyzed the students' interviews. She says one of the questions was to ask them how they felt about talking about suicide during the interviews.
They wanted to talk about the effects on other people. They wanted to talk about the cultural implications, how there's a lot of silencing and we don't talk about this person because we don't want to glorify them, and how the grieving process was changed because of that, perhaps, how they were affected, because a lot of people were very profoundly affected.
Students said more suicide prevention programs are needed in rural Alaska, but service providers need to find a way around the lack of confidentiality in small communities, which they say deters people from seeking help from professionals. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A group in Bethel has been advocating for decades for a swimming pool so community members can have a safe place to learn to swim. Their efforts finally got a $23 million boost when Governor Sean Parnell signed the state's budget. From member station KYUK, Mark Earhart has more.
Dear Governor Parnell, I think we need a pool because we need people to learn to swim and keep us healthy. Mostly every town has one, but Bethel doesn't.
Dear Governor, please sign the contract so we can learn how to swim and have fun in the pool and slide.
so I can have more fun during the weekends, and so I can swim more, and also so I can learn how to swim without a bubble.
Luke Snow, Bailey Tucker, and Owen Kepler are in the second grade at Bethel's Mikilngutlitnauvat Elementary School. Their class wrote letters to Alaska Governor Sean Parnell asking for assistance in Bethel's effort to get a swimming pool, an effort that is much, much older than they are.
The effort for a swimming pool in Bethel has been ongoing through the decades. In the 50s and 60s, there were people trying to get something for Bethel. In the 70s, when I moved home, an effort was started, and again in the 80s.
Beverly Hoffman is part of the YK Delta Lifesavers, a group that has been lobbying to get a swimming pool in the community for quite a while in its own right.
The Lifesavers started getting active and raising money to show community support in the early 90s.
The group has held everything from dances to bake sales and open gyms, trying to scrape together enough funds for the pool, not just as a place for kids to play or blow off steam, but as a way to potentially save lives.
The first summer that we started our group, there were over 15, 17 drownings in the YK Delta.
The city of Bethel has gotten behind the project, donating the project site and even adding a half-cent city sales tax that has raised around $3 million since 2007. But in an area where materials have to be barged in and milk can even reach upwards of $9 a gallon, $3 million wasn't even close to enough. The city asked the governor for $24 million and received close to that amount, $23,075,000 to be exact. Hoffman thinks that the money will be enough.
It's all doable. The cost was in $2,015. And, you know, with the high cost of fuel and all of that, it's good to have that buffer.
Hoffman says she thinks that the pool could be open in as early as 2 years from now. And that would be just fine for a certain group of future fourth graders.
I think it means to me that it's really exciting and that so everybody can learn how to swim so they can have fun.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Daisha Eaton, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Do you own a business or manage employees? Do you reassure employees with children that you're committed to supporting them? Well, research shows that employees who feel supported at work when handling their parenting challenges are more loyal and more productive. When you let employees know they can attend a parent-teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality childcare, you contribute to stronger families. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.